Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. And those are protesters KUOW's Anna Tadashev recorded outside Seattle Town Hall last week on the night of a talk by our guest for this episode, Henry Hank Paulson. People tend to have strong opinions about Paulson. Depending on your point of view, he may have either saved the U.S. economy as we know it or allowed it to be brought to its knees in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Time magazine hedged its bets. It called Paulson one of the 25 people to blame for the financial crisis, but said his response amounted to the only path out. Proponents of bailing out homeowners instead of bankers still beg to differ. Paulson worked for the Nixon administration in the 70s before joining banking giant Goldman Sachs. He went on to become CEO of Goldman in 1999. In 2006, he was named the 74th U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. He stayed on as secretary while the financial crisis raged and into the first years of the Obama administration. In 2001, he founded the Paulson Institute at the University of Chicago. Its mission is to support international engagement and sustainable economic and environmental policies. The Institute has a special focus on the relationship between the U.S. and China. Though his introduction to China relations came by accident, as he'll explain, Paulson became a dedicated ambassador and change agent. His efforts to open up China to private enterprise began in his early days at Goldman Sachs. Then, as Treasury Secretary, he created the Strategic Economic Dialogue, a framework for economic discussion and cooperation between the two superpowers. Paulson's new book is Dealing with China, An Insider Unmasks the New Economic Superpower. In it, he addresses China's economic strengths and weaknesses. He explores ways the U.S. can do business there and influence its government and environmental impact. Paulson argues that the climate change crisis is potentially worse than the 2008 financial crisis because it threatens, quote, the way of life as we know it on our planet. Henry Paulson joined Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella in a conversation at Town Hall Seattle on June 25, 2015. The event was presented by Town Hall, University Bookstore, and the Washington State China Relations Council as part of the Civics Series. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Stay tuned at the end of this podcast for interviews with protesters outside this appearance by Henry Paulson at Town Hall Seattle.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Hank, for coming to Seattle on such a great day here. I was really looking forward to our conversation, and when I sort of read up about you, I read the book, one thing that struck me is there seem to be three passions that have run through all that you've done in life. Of course, there's this belief in markets and what markets can do. For societies, there's the belief in the importance of the environment and the belief in American values and principles. And you brought all of these three things to focus with a love for China. And so I'm really looking forward to having a conversation on how that all came about. And maybe we can start by talking about why China and why now?
Well, Satya, first of all, thank you, and thank you all for being here tonight. This is one of my very most favorite cities in the whole world. I love it. It's terrific to be back here. China. I'd say the reason I am spending time on China right now and the reason I wrote the book on China is I think each one of us in our own way wants to be involved in an area where we have the best chance of making a difference and being useful. And I have spent a lot of time in China over the years building up relationships. I dedicated the book dealing with China to my grandchildren, you know, two of whom are in Portland, because I want them to grow up in a, you know, in a peaceful world, a prosperous world, a world that's environmentally sound.
The U.S. relationship with the NATO or the allies, how would you sort of, historically, how would you rate this?
They're the allies, and those relationships are incredibly important. And I'm not saying they're not without issues, but they're not troubled, okay? And the relationship with China is going to be increasingly complex and difficult. We have, with China, the second largest economy in the world. And, you know, something would have to go terribly wrong in China for them not to knock us off the perch that we've had for 150 years as being the largest economy. And they've emerged as a formidable competitor. And so we're competing in certain areas, and we have all these common interests. We're a shared interest where we need to work together. So as I look at it, and you look at history, you can't find examples in history where you have a predominant power and a rising power where they don't come to conflict. People often will say, what about the UK and the US? Well, they forget they burned down our White House in 1812. You know, and I don't think conflict is inevitable by any means, and a Cold War isn't an inevitable, and it would be a very bad thing. And so, to me, the reason this relationship is so important is if I look at the major issues that we care about, I happen to view climate change as a huge economic risk for this world. And so talk about climate change. We have the two largest economies, the two largest emitters of carbon, and it is imperative our two countries lead the way if we're going to avoid the worst outcomes.
I think that's a great report. I mean, there's a civilizational power that is China, and coming to perhaps terms with its place in the new world order, yeah, and with U.S. And so maybe we can even start, Hank, unpacking this, starting perhaps even with the markets, because one of the things that struck me when reading your book was, especially when you were, you know, really working with Zhu Rongji, was he had a vision for a new model for the economic development of China. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about how should one make sense of that model? That's not a model that you learn in the University of Chicago, for sure. Yeah. So how would you describe that model, and what stage are we in?
Okay, well, so there's Sacha, you have a lot in that question in terms of what. So, and brevity isn't my virtue. I could talk about that for, you know, there's a lot of pages in the book on that. But I would say this. So what got me interested in spending time there when I was at Goldman Sachs was the fact that the leaders, the reformists, and they had to do some very courageous things, you know, to open up, because there was a lot of resistance internally, to open up their economy to competition, and they used Western bankers and capital markets transactions to attract Western capital and know-how and open up the economy to competition. So I'll give you just a couple quick stories from the book, and then we'll answer your question. Because I made my first trip to China in 1992, and we didn't have a presence there at Goldman Sachs. We had a few people in the Hong Kong office, and I had a businessman who knew a lot about China and who went on to become the first CEO of Hong Kong after the handover, asked me if I wanted to go in when he was having a meeting with Jiang Zemin, who was a general secretary of the Communist Party and president. And of course I wanted to do that. And we went in, and it was very formal, sitting around this big circle. It seemed very foreign, a totally different language and history and culture and the Communist Party. And so near the end of the meeting, he said, Mr. President, this young man works at Goldman Sachs, and they're trying to figure out whether they should expand in China. So now Jiang Zemin thinks he's going to impress me, so he starts speaking in English, and he says names of U.S. companies, Microsoft, GE, Boeing, and all of these, and I smile. And then he said, Mr. Paulson, we need to learn U.S.-style accounting. And then with a perfectly straight face, he looks me in the eye and says, assets equal liabilities plus equity. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure Bill Clinton would know that. And I didn't know that a few years ago. And so here's the head. And so I then went back. I said, I think these guys are serious. Well, what they did in terms of taking some of these companies public, you know, with the PetroChina, which was the big state-owned oil company, there were 1.5 million direct employees. There were 6 million on the company, you know, taken care of by the company. When you look at their families, because they took care of their families, they housed them. The company ran schools, stores, hospitals. And, you know, I had one of my colleagues say that that's like a medieval city. You can't float that on the New York Stock Exchange. But they went through huge political risk in terms of the kinds of layoffs they need to go through and so on to do this. But they did it so that to put China in a situation where they could create the kinds of jobs they need to create, opening the country up to competition. But what Zhu Rongji began, and a number of the people that were characters in the book that I worked with then, who are now very senior leaders, they began the idea of opening up to competition and reform and scaling back, you know, the state-owned enterprises. And they also did with really radical, one of the chapters I have is cleaning out the stables at Guangdong, and that's about the first bankruptcy. Right. Because let me tell you, that was radical. That was in China, the idea that a failing company could fail was really radical stuff, but you had to do that to let the system work. So it was an economic miracle in the sense that the private sector was what created the jobs, the competition, took, you know, hundreds of millions out of poverty. But then reform stalled. And their idea of reform was never to make themselves look like us, okay? They always were going to have a different system, going to have a role for state-owned companies. But I think the leaders I started working with in the late 90s wanted to continue to open it up and continue to have reform take place, but they have strong vested interests there that fought reform. Reform stalled for 10 or 12 years. The current model has run out of steam. And to all those that say to me, gee, have they developed a better form of capitalism, I'll say, heck no. And they've got a huge challenge now to reboot a $10 trillion economy. And it's going to be very difficult. And there's opposition and there's vested interests. But the key is going to be scaling back these big monopolies and letting the private sector come in and compete in more areas.
It's actually pretty fascinating. I mean, the state-owned enterprises themselves, they are obviously started the reforms and they've reached a particular state. The other thing is, if you look at the top 10 tech companies today, three of them are Chinese. And in fact, they're opening up offices in Seattle and recruiting here and so on. So it's interesting to see how, in some sense, maybe we could say the reform of the state-owned enterprises is slowed down a bit, but their private sector is becoming globally competitive. And so how do you make, what's the way for us to reason about China? It's private sector, in fact.
Yeah, it is the private sector. 70%, Sacha, you're right, 70% of the jobs are from the private sector. And it's fascinating because when you look at those, the companies you referred to, they, again, these men are characters in the book, a lot of them, because it was a terrific opportunity for people in the early days. Jack Ma is someone who runs Alibaba that I write about, we'd worked with. He's very interested in conservation also. So he's chairman of the China Board of the Nature Conservancy, and I started working with him years ago. And a man who's the president, another big company, Tencent,
right,
which is the guy who is the president and chief operating officer, was one of the guys that worked as a junior banker on the PetroChina IPO. So the private sector has opened up, and it's creating jobs, but the economy overall has really stalled, and it's been very reliant not on the state-owned enterprises as much, but on heavy government investment at the municipal level in infrastructure, some of which is needed, some of which isn't needed, which is causing debt to rise very quickly. And they need to, and they need to say, how do we fix the municipal finance system? And growth has slowed way down. And where's additional growth going to come from? It's going to have to come from areas like telecommunications, finance, energy, where the state-owned enterprises are really strong, and they're going to have to take those companies and put them on a level playing field. So there's quite an interesting...
Right, and there seems to be a change in even their orientation where they're moving from growth that's driven primarily through exports to a lot more of internal consumption. So do you think that that's where the future growth's going to come?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be domestic-led growth, consumption, and exports has been a big part, but also a huge part of the growth has been government investment,
right.
Okay, which is, if you're a mayor in the U.S., you know, depending on what city and what state, you're probably responsible for 25% of the total spending. You do, you know, police, fire, education. But a lot of education comes from the federal government and the state. In China, at the city level, they have responsibility for doing a far, up to 50% or more of the spending, because they've got responsibility for not just police and fire, but all education, the social safety nets, and they don't have budget control or the revenues they need. So if you're a Chinese mayor and you want to increase, you want to create jobs, what you've been doing is taking land from someone.
Right.
So you've got huge property tax, huge property rights issues, and it's a big cause of social distress and unrest. You take the land from someone, you sell it to a developer, and you then finance this with debt. And they've been doing it off balance sheet in these local government finance vehicles and investing in infrastructure. And debt's been growing much faster than the economy is growing. The leaders understand this, but to fix the problem, they have to come up with a different municipal finance system, and that's easier said than done. And so they've got challenges. So everyone that says, "Boy, aren't you afraid China's going to outcompete us or eat our lunch?" You can make is. I think they've got, I think they're wrong, and I think you can make as big a mistake, sort of, exaggerating China's strength as you can underestimating its potential.
Yeah, it's a great point. I had not realized, in fact, the debt-to-GDP ratio being that much more higher there. Maybe we should talk a little bit about how should we engage? I know you were instrumental in getting the SED started, and Michael mentioned even this week there was the seventh round of it.
Seventh round with this administration.
Yeah.
We did, when I was there, we did two, we did five rounds.
But what do you make, so how should we engage?
Well, that's a interesting question, because what we have is, today we have a new China. And I think we need some different approaches and some adjustment. But the strategic economic dialogue was a vehicle that I put in place under President Bush to help manage the relationship, because I watched it from the private sector, and I didn't think the government was dealing with it very effectively, because in the Chinese have a decision-making process where it's very diffuse, as you know. There's all kinds of people, those that have, you know, they're on the organization chart and have, you know, and have the stated authority to make decisions, and then many others that get involved in the decision-making process. So the idea of the strategic economic dialogue was, how do you get all of the right people in the room? So you have a broad group of cabinet secretaries and ministers on each side. So take the environmental. You know, if I just talked to the environmental minister in China, and that's being increasingly upgraded, but I wouldn't get nothing done. They don't have a lot of power. But if I wanted to talk about environmental issues, it was great to have, you know, other members of the Politburo there. Or if we wanted to talk about currency, and Ben Bernanke was there with me, rather than just speaking to the head of the central bank, he's talking to the political leaders. That was important. And also, it was very important. Their decision-making process works best when there's direction from above, helping form a consensus below. And so the idea that you could clearly prioritize was important. And the other thing, which I think is just essential, was essential then and it's essential today. And I'm going to tell you why. We've got all these areas where we've got differences, and then this even bigger group of areas where we have a shared interest.
Right.
And it makes no difference to have a shared interest if you don't turn those into some tangible accomplishments, where you work together and people in both countries can see the advantages of the relationship. And so the strategic economic dialogue is a vehicle where you do that. It's not just a dialogue. You also, you talk about long-term issues and then you negotiate things along the way. And you use this to force action. And, you know, a good example was you know, I used... We could talk about all kinds of examples.
Currency.
But currency was a very, very important example. We, all through the financial crisis, the fact that I had a vehicle to talk to the Chinese, because they were very good partners. And let me tell you, it's hard to understand our political system. And so they would see me up at Congress getting my brains knocked out as I was looking for authorities to keep us from going into economic, you know, an Armageddon, and so at daytime I'd be doing that, and at night I'd be on the phone with Wang Qishang, who I'd worked with for years, and saying, well, you know, trust me, that's our political system. It's noisy, but at the end we do the right things, and you know, please hang on to your securities and don't sell, and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, no, I think This idea that two great powers have a strategic framework and an ability to have a continuous dialogue, I think, is very powerful. And we'll come back to that even. Maybe let's move to your other passion. You talk a lot about, you already made lots of references to the environment. Obviously, you think of the environment globally, and you also think about it very deeply in the context of China. Maybe you can talk about, how does the Chinese leadership itself view the environment? What do you see happening there?
Well, again, Sacha, you've got so much involved in your question. So I had started off, before I got to government, I was not focused on climate change. I read about it, I'd heard about it. It was something for government. So when I was in the private sector, I was very interested in conservation. And so I have a chapter in the book, Saving Shangri-La, about working with the Nature Conservancy to set up the Asia Pacific Council. And there's an area, you know, in southwest China that has got spectacular biodiversity. It's got these four big rivers, Mekong, you know, Yangtze, Salween, Irrawaddy, all within, you know, 50 miles of each other, going from subtropical rainforest to five peaks over 20,000 feet, great wildflowers and so on. So I put together a group where we had Chinese leaders, business people, people from the U.S., all on this council. And for instance, Wang Xuechang, who is now runs the anti-corruption campaign, was my counterpart during the strategic economic dialogue, was there. And I could see that I was surprised to find wild, beautiful places in China. And I also learned that the Chinese were willing to, really, there was a small number, but a really committed conservationists. Now, this is, there's also something I care deeply about, which is China's ecological footprint outside of the country, because this is the second largest economy in the world, as we've talked about. Half of the all buildings going up in the world are going up in China. So they take half of all cement, half of all steel is produced and consumed there. And the Chinese are making investments throughout Africa and infrastructure, Latin America. So now, if you care about climate change, you can't really get at that problem without working with China. And the leaders care deeply about that right now, because air quality is, you know, the dirty air is killing people. I've got one chapter called Darkness at Noon, and it's a serious problem, and I think they don't believe the Communist Party will stay in power unless they make progress. And they also care about climate change, because they understand it and they're seriously working on it. That's the good news. The bad news is they've taken all kinds of actions and they've been blown away by the explosive breakneck growth. And then in terms of their investments outside of the country, I think they're increasingly care about that, but they haven't been responsible investors environmentally. Their investment has been welcomed by Africa and Latin America. I believe that the two big economic events, you know, coming out of China in the next 25 years will be the next 300 million people going to the city in China. Right. Yeah, you know, they've already got 650 million there, another 300 million. Think of it. And because they have a urbanization plan that also is broken in terms of just it creates all sorts of pollution and stress. And then the other big event will be going out strategy. Chinese companies making investments, you know, in the developing world and the developed world. And they're not all as responsible as Jack Ma and Alibaba and some of the technology companies. And so the point I make is to the leaders is that going out is going to be very important. And that's going to be the lens through which the rest of the world looks at China. And they're going to need to develop their own corporate governance standards, their standards for hiring and training people and giving back. And the very best companies, best of class in the world, are the ones with the best environmental practices.
Yeah.
So again, you can see, you asked me an environmental question, I'm not terribly brief because I care a lot about this, I think it's very hard to figure out how we are going to maintain our ecosystem without, you know, having China play a very important role.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the way you just described some of the challenges, obviously, given the rate of urbanization, just the magnitude of urbanization, the environmental issue in China today, I think it's going to require ingenious solutions, which I see a lot of optimism when I think about some of the entrepreneurial activity and even some of the best minds of China going to work on it.
Yeah.
It might be that some of the tech that solves the global environmental issues come out of China. That might, in fact, be their next export, which I see a lot of optimism around that.
Yeah, Sanjay, you're right. And you've got to be an optimist to work in this area. You know, if you're a pessimist, you'd slit your throat. But I think what it takes to deal with climate change is to have new clean technologies be developed and then deployed so they're cost effective in, you know, in emerging markets. And China is by far the leader in emerging markets in wanting to deal with this issue. And I think one of the things the Paulson Institute is focused on is how to help the Chinese develop the financing techniques and the funding techniques to incentivize the private sector, because the government's not going to have enough money to roll out these new clean technologies. And this is a really, really important area for the U.S. and China to work together, because no one can innovate like we can. When you look at cities like Seattle, when you look at our national labs, at our great research universities, at our private equity and venture capital and all of that, and no one can roll out technologies in scale and test them quicker in China, given the size of their energy markets. So there's a natural, but we need to break down some of those barriers, because it's such a huge problem.
No, it's amazing. One of the, maybe switching gears a little bit, one of the fun parts of your book was all the characters. You worked with many, you know, both when you were in investment banking and then as Treasury Secretary. What makes the people you worked with, how do you characterize them, you know, when compared to the people you run into the rest in the West?
Well, that, again, you know, it's an interesting, I'll tell you a story. So, for instance, a lot of people that go to China, they're Chinese scholars, they learn the language, the history, all of that. I wish I could say I did that. I had intellectual curiosity, but in other areas. So I had never any particular interest in going into China. I went by accident the first time. I was living in Chicago. I did not want to move to New York. When I became co-head of the investment banking division, my co-head in New York said, why don't I take Europe when we look at international, and Asia is closer to Chicago, why don't you take Asia? And so with that, I went to Hong Kong. I told you about my first meeting with Jiang Zemin. But I would say the other thing I learned after you spent time there, at first it just seemed so different. But I found the people very similar in terms of very easy for Americans, very straightforward when you get to know them, great sense of humor, easy to communicate with, tough to negotiate with, but at least I found that when you had a deal, you didn't have a legal system, so it was a company not ruled by laws but by men, but you had a handshake, that was a good handshake. And the other thing that kept me going back there was they weren't ideological. They were pragmatic. When they wanted to solve a problem, they looked anywhere in the world they could for the solution and then moved fast and tried to figure out how to implement it in China. And there's some very interesting, you know, everyone thinks of the Chinese as also being very scripted and so on, and many of them are, but, you know, the leaders that were the ones that were the reformers, you know, Zhu Wanji, who I talked about, or this guy Wang Qishang, who I started working with in the very early reforms, then was on the Nature Conservancy Board, then was a vice premier, my counterpart in the SED, and is now one of the very top people on the Standing Committee. Again, a terrific communicator. And I'll just tell you one story about Wang Qishang, because he's very, very quick. He didn't speak any English. I didn't speak Chinese, but great sense of humor, and you really got to know him. Well, because I'm sticking with the environment, and the book is not all about the environment, but on the environment, on the SED, Strategic Economic Dialogue, so in June of 2008, which is the last one we had in the U.S., we then went to China late that year. So this is before the worst part of the financial crisis, but in the financial crisis. So he shows up, and I'd been pounding on him to open up their financial sector, and he arrived, and this is in the financial crisis, and he said, you know, Hank, you used to be our teacher, but our teacher doesn't look so smart anymore. You know, we're going to have, and And he was kidding, but he was being very serious, and he understood the importance of opening up. But given the fact that we had all our problems in our financial sector, he was understandably having problems with his colleagues. And he then, when he got pushed, I got against a bunch of congressional leaders together over Treasury, and they started pushing him on the environment. And he cares a lot about the environment, because he said to me, you know, earlier, he said, you know, we have, you know, you've given us very bad practices. We've got a billion Chinese, it was a smaller country then, that want to live the way you live in the U.S. And there are not enough resources in the world for us to live the way you live. So he's in Washington, and he's getting pressed. And he finally looks at this senator who's pressing him, and he says, listen, you know, it was a hot day. Maybe not as hot as it's up here on this stage right now, but it was a 90-degree day in Washington. So he said to this senator or congressman, he said, listen, you're lecturing me. He said, I stay in a hotel, and it's so cold with the air conditioning, I got to bundle up. Then I go in your fitness center, and people are exercising air-conditioned. They're exercising. Then they take a very hot shower. Then they walk out and get in their air-conditioned car. You know, and you're telling me about the environment. So again, there are people that knew how to mix it up.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the other things that you did was your involvement with Tsinghua and the starting of the business school there, the School of Economics. We just, in fact, last week, between University of Washington and Tsinghua, got a new institute, or we announced the intent to open a new institute, which we're very excited about. It looks like the managerial capacity of the country is also improving at a very rapid pace. Any comments on that?
Yeah, well, you're right. So I agree with that. And the way that came about was with this outstanding premier, Zhu Ranjie. We had the first privatization they'd done, or IPO, was China Mobile. It was called China Telecom at the time. And we had priced that right at the, you know, on Black Friday, just as in the middle of the Asian financial crisis. And, you know, so the deal was, people were really questioning how it would work. And you forget how much they needed the money, because I was with Wang Qishang when he calls the boss and Zhu Ranji, and he says the deal's closed. And Zhu Ranji says, what does that mean? Do we have the $4.2 billion yet? And he said, yes, real gold and silver, Chinese expression. And the boss says, I'll believe it when we got it. So we then had a meeting afterwards, and he was feeling very pleased that it behaved so well, that the stock had performed well. And he had said to me, there's this Chinese proverb, the one beautiful flower in the garden, and that's what China Mobile is. You know, it stayed stable in the middle of a financial crisis. And we're talking about the success. And then I explained that going public was one thing, but it was going to take having really good managers, and he understood. And it was, you couldn't take party hacks and put them in charge and have them run a company like that. And he said, we need more talent. He looked at the guy we had who worked on this, and he said, if we had 10 guys like you, we would turn around our whole state-owned enterprises, 100 we turn around our country. How do we train? And so that was where I took on the assignment to work with Harvard Business School and MIT and help develop Tsinghua School of Economics and Management, where you're now on the board.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Maybe, I don't know how it's going to work. Is it, am I getting questions? Is somebody giving me those? Yeah, great. Maybe while I wait for the audience questions, let me ask you this. Maybe turn our attention to the U.S. What do you make of our economy?
Well, I'm going to say something about our economy. I'm going to relate it to what's going on in China now and what's going on everywhere, most big countries in the world. If I look at China, if I look at Japan, if I look at Europe, if I look at Brazil, I see a situation where the policies that worked in the past no longer are working the way they should in this century. So it takes, and I feel the same way about the U.S. So it takes, we need to adjust our policies. And it's very unpopular to adjust them in every country. People think China's got an authoritarian government. It does. But still, it's very hard to build consensus. So Xi Jinping, who is the current leader, has amassed all of this power, and he still doesn't have consensus on what he needs to do. So now I'll talk about the U.S. I look at our economy, and I say, on the one hand, we've got the strongest economy by far. We've got fewer problems than China has, or Europe has, or Brazil has, or just about Japan has. But we've grown at essentially 2% since the third quarter of 2009, while we've delevered. And we haven't grown quickly enough. And the other thing is we've got this really frustrating problem of income disparity. And that's a problem in China, a huge problem. It's a problem in Europe. It's a problem a lot of places. And we can discuss where that comes from. I happen to think a big part of it is that so much of the innovation today makes our lives better in many, many ways. We don't want to turn it back. It can't turn it back, but it destroys jobs. And so I don't care if you look at engineering, if you look at law, if you look at most phases of architecture, business, whatever. If it can be routinized, it's done by computers. Winner take all at the top, and so there's some fundamental problems. And so I really believe, on the one hand, I can look at the positive signs and look at wages are starting to come up a bit, right? We're creating jobs at a nice rate, but we still, if our unemployment is still too high, the housing market has come back. But we've got some real headwinds in terms of what's going on around us, and you know, and the dollar's moving up, and I think we're more or less going to be in this rut, unless we do some fundamentally things different. Unless we get a new tax system, let's just get the revenues we need in this century. We deal with entitlements in a different way. We get really fundamental immigration reform, where we don't send some of the best and brightest students to get degrees here home, and we deal with this perplexing problem of, you know, making sure people have got the skills we need to succeed. So the good news is we're creating jobs, we're growing, we're doing better than just about every other place. Businesses are doing great. Businesses are outperforming. They're better managed than they've ever been. CEOs get more criticism than ever before, but CEOs are better. And I'm not just saying that because I'm here with you. And when I'm with retired CEOs and they all say, "Oh yeah, CEOs aren't what they used to be," I have to say, "Yeah, they're better today. The job is much, much more difficult." And when you look at how well our companies are doing relative to some of the constraints they've got at the government level, it's fabulous. So we've got some real strengths, but we need policy change. And I don't think we're going to grow at much above 2%, or we're not going to grow fast enough until we get these fundamentals. And that's going to be more about how our political system works than the economic system.
Yeah, that's more love than I'll ever get, I think. Let me take the first question from the audience. What's your analysis of the trade agreements currently in Congress?
Okay, well, I'll just say right now, I am a big proponent of trade to begin with, so I'll declare myself. I happen to believe when you've got 4% of the world's population, you're setting yourself up for failure if you're not trying to do business with the other 96%. And I also believe that even the people who, and there are some dislocations, there's some job losses as a result of trade and globalization, but there's more job created and more benefit. But even those that disagree with me should be for the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the trade deal, you know, that the Obama administration is working on, because our markets are basically open. They're much more open than others. And so these agreements are creating more opportunity for U.S. workers and companies. So what I would say is this, and the other thing is China, as we have healthy competition with China, China uses its economic linkages to help drive its policies around the, you know, its priorities around the world, just like we do. And we need to be there if we're going to compete. We can't look inward. And so I sort of wince. I'm not a partisan person, but when I look at all the Democrats that are, it's so hard to get them to vote for trade. Meanwhile, the Republicans, my party, don't want to reform the IMF and fund it, and or fund the Ex-Im Bank. You know, when you look at what that means to important companies like Boeing that are job creators here, I just sort of wince. So again, I am all for these. They got to be negotiated properly, and of course, the president needs trade promotion authority to negotiate the best deal.
That's good. Great questions here. So one is, who is more precarious? Who is in a more precarious position? China for owning so much U.S. debt, or U.S. for being so far in debt?
That's a sophisticated question because the questioner understands, and that's usually the way I answer the question, because I usually, it comes to me, aren't you worried that the Chinese own so much of our debt? And I would say, I'm worried that we have so much debt. That's what I'm worried about. And we're going to be the predominant power in the world for a long time, regardless of what happens to China does or doesn't do, if we fix our, if we restore our economic competitiveness. And there's no instance ever in history where the nation continue to be a power if they have too much debt and if they lose their fiscal respectability and discipline. Now, China, why do they invest in our debt? Because it's their interest to do so. If you're China, would you rather invest in the euro? Would you rather invest in Japanese yen? I mean, where are they going to invest? And I'd say this, that they have a much smaller percentage of our debt than we have of their foreign exchange reserves. So it's as important as it is to us, it's much more important to them.
The next question is, beyond what you've shared tonight, what is the greatest misconception you've seen people of power in the United States have of China?
Well, there's a lot of misconceptions. And I would say that there's really, I think one big misconception is a view that if we don't like certain things about what China's doing, and we clearly not going to like things. I don't like a lot of things what they're doing. But somehow or other we can say, okay, let's just be tough. We should be tougher. And of course, we need to be strong militarily, economically, diplomatically. But the fact is, it is in our interest. I think people, it's not just one misconception. There's so many people that have opinions that have never been to China or don't understand it. And take a U.S.-centric view and view that everything we do is the best and every other company should do it. And if they don't do it, somehow they're wrong. And so, to me, when people say to me, why are you trying to help China? I look at them and say, I'm a patriot. I'm trying to help the United States of America. And in the areas I'm working in, it's in our strong interest. Why shouldn't we be trying to open up markets there for U.S. companies? Why shouldn't we be trying to attract investment from China to create jobs here? Why shouldn't we be working with them to solve the environmental problems there are in the world? But I'd say this, they don't understand our political system, and we as Americans don't like or understand theirs.
Yeah. Let me take another one. Did we miss an opportunity to advance global environmental protection by not addressing sustainable development in the TPP negotiations?
oh my gosh, you know, again, such naivete in some ways, but it's a right thing to ask. So it's well intended. The TPP, when people are against the TPP because their environmental standards aren't high enough, I say, what are environmental standards going to be if you don't have a TPP? So to me, this went farther than anything that's ever been done before. I'm not there negotiating it. I sure have a great confidence in Mike Froman. He actually called me and asked me for help in terms of getting some environmental groups to work with him and help him understand the issues. I think the trade-off between economic growth and environment is really critical, because I don't think any economic growth is going to be sustainable if we're not environmentally responsible, and we're not going to be able to deal with environmental problems if there's not a certain amount of economic success. So it is finding the balance. And would I like to have there be more environmental protections? Yeah, I happen to, you know, you can't have enough for me in many ways. But the idea, if we don't do that deal, we're not going to have them. And I think we've got to look at it and say it's a big step forward if we get it done.
That's great. How about the last question? How would young university students who want to work for social and environmental good with China go about choosing a vocation?
Well, there's all kinds of ways you can do this. Because remember, wanting to do something is really important. Wanting to do something, but you need the skill set to do it. And you can develop the skill set in different ways. I had, when I grew up, I sure wasn't looking to be a banker. I wanted to be a forest ranger. Then I wanted to be a English, you know, I was going to go to Oxford and study English. I ended up in business school. It was a serendipitous way I ended up there. But yet, from the time I began working at Goldman Sachs, I always figured out I chaired the Nature Conservancy. I started the Asia Pacific Council of the Nature Conservancy. I chaired the Peregrine Fund. And I felt that the skills I had in the private sector helped me with some of the other issues. Other students go and get great degrees in environmental sciences. They're just terrific degrees you can get. And then I think you need to go and work someplace where you get things done. Because my advice to every young person is this. It's one thing to know the right answer, you know, and there's a lot of people that know the right answer. But it does you no good unless you can convince other people and you can get things done. That's part of what's wrong with our political system right now. We have too many ideologues who say it's my way or the highway. And so the key is to figure out how to compromise and how to get things done. The other thing I do is chair a Latin American Conservation Council with a lot of business leaders. And one of the things we're working on is smart infrastructure financing. Again, with the Nature Conservancy, why are we doing that? Because most environmentalists have never seen any infrastructure they like. They've never seen a dam they like. They've never seen a mine they like. They've never seen an oil well they like. And, you know, I was sort of among that group for a while. But we know with a building, there's a standard. There's a LEED standard energy-efficient building. Well, there's no incentive for politicians to work with environmentalists because if you work with us, they're going to oppose whatever you do. You know, just like the people that oppose the trade agreement, okay? There's no trade agreement that certain environmentalists will like because some of them just don't like it. And so what we're trying to do with smart infrastructure is work with business and government to say it's a lot better. We need infrastructure. It's going to be developed. There's a right way to do a dam. It does less damage. You know, when we worked on the parks in Yunnan, you know, when there was they were going to build a dam across this one of the rivers that we just in an ecologically pristine area. you know, there's a tendency to say, well, let's try to kill the dams. But we brought in some great U.S. experts and hydrologists and worked with the Chinese and say, well, if you build it here as opposed to there, it'll do less damage. And if you design it this way, you can have fewer dams. And so, again, I think there's a lot of ways for young people to get involved, but it's going to come down to, I'd like to have them all get the people skills and the ability to compromise and work in different cultures or with different interest groups to figure out how to get things done.
Thank you. Thank you, Hank, for the conversation. That was great.
Before this appearance by Henry Paulson, a group of protesters gathered outside Town Hall, Seattle. KUOW's Anna Tadashev brought us these interviews.
I'm Josh Ferris.
And are you the organizer of this event? Or?
No, I just showed up. I heard about it. I'm running for city council in Seattle, District 2.
So why are you guys protesting today?
I was still waiting for the protesters to show up, but they're on activist time. We are, I think, about to protest this guy because he's the guy that bailed the banks out and sold the whole country out. He's the guy that started the Occupy movement, and he's the guy that's responsible for 20 million foreclosures. This is the representative of the 1%, the former Goldman Sachs CEO, and the former Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson. If anybody owns this gross inequality that we suffered with the waves of austerity after the crash and throughout the Great Recession and the jobless recovery, it's Hank Paulson. So we're here to protest him today.
Okay, what kind of social change do you hope to stir up because of this?
Well, we want to remind people that the 1% are having a good old time, still making money hand over fist, while a lot of people are suffering. And a lot of people lost their homes and lost all their savings, pensions. Some people actually it killed them. And we really think this guy's a criminal, human rights criminal. He sold the whole country out. I don't know. I think if I was president of the United States, I would have gone after him for treason.
Is there anything else you guys want to say before we go?
Once this starts, I'm going to go inside and listen to what he has to say, very respectfully.
So can you just say your name for me?
My name is Jean Barton.
All right, and why are you guys protesting today?
Well, Hank Paulson was a CEO of Goldman Sachs from 1997 to 2006, and during that time, he made millions and millions of dollars off of bundling mortgages and putting them on Wall Street. 2006, he was hired by Bush to become Secretary of Treasury. There, he was the architect of the bank bailout. So he made $54 million, and we, as a country, bailed out the entire bank system. So that's why we're here, because he is at the top of the pyramid.
So what kind of social change do you guys hope to do with this protest?
We just, people are forgetting, you know, that a few years ago this man was a corporate criminal. He helped stage this whole thing, and he knew when he left Goldman Sachs that the mortgage-backed securities that they had on Wall Street were going to be no good, that they turned around and put their money and banked against him, bet against him. So they were perfectly aware this was going to happen. So we want to remind people this can happen again. And this man who's here, who's getting such a warm welcome, he had a lot to do with it.
Do you have any personal reasons for being here today?
Yes, our house was foreclosed on. My husband was dragged out of our house by the King County Sheriff, put into an ambulance and left there. The people here threw themselves on the ambulance the police took him out and left him on the streets with no clothes, no food, no water, nothing. We appealed to the city council and to the mayor, and we went into court, and we were supposed to have 40 days to resolve it, and the King County Police came in within less than a week after the decision, 4 days after the decision, and took me to jail and hauled him off to, start off at the Veterans Hospital. But he ended up in a nursing home for 3 months. Plus, it cost us a whole lot of money in the ambulance charges and the emergency charges and the hospital and all for corporate greed.
And were there people, like, actually here today that helped with the ambulance when that happened?
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of these people.
So do you guys all know each other then?
Most of us.
So how did you come to be organized?
Stand Against Foreclosures and Evictions. This man over here, Josh Ferris, he's the founder of that organization almost 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, and he's now running for city council on behalf of the regular people so that he wants to have a moratorium on evictions. He would like to see rent control. He wants to make the whole thing work for regular people instead of all for corporate profit.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Henry Paulson worked for the Nixon administration in the 1970s before joining banking giant Goldman Sachs. He went on to become CEO of Goldman in 1999. In 2006, he was named the 74th U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Paulson joined Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella in a conversation at Town Hall Seattle on June 25, 2015. The event was presented by Town Hall, University Bookstore, and the Washington State China Relations Council as part of the Civic Series. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.